Politica for our fall screening series. Monday, November 21st, Primera, a film on the Chilean uprising. Monday, November 28th, The Clabona Keepers, looking at indigenous land and water defenders on the west coast of Turtle Island. Monday, December 5th, Into the Weeds, a celebrated documentary that looks at the struggle against multinational pesticide company Monsanto. These films show on Mondays at 7 p.m. in room H110 at Concordia University, 1455 de Maisonneuve West, Metro Guy Concordia. Info, cinemapolitica.org. These screenings are a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
Je sais que je suis un bon père de famille. Je sais que je suis un collègue apprécié au bureau. Je sais que je suis un pas pire joueur de hockey. Je sais que je prends bien soin de ma fille qui vit avec des handicaps, même si c'est pas toujours facile. Mais je ne sais pas que je suis une personne proche aidante.
Ce n'est pas toujours évident de le savoir. Si vous soutenez une personne une fois par mois, une fois par semaine ou chaque jour, vous êtes une personne proche aidante. Les personnes proches aidantes, elles sont plus qu'on pense. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
It's quite revolutionary to be able to speak openly about the oppression that we face as Palestinian people in the Israeli prisons, but also the occupation, the Israeli occupation on Palestine is something that we need to speak about more in the art world, and we need to also find ways to do it.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. When we first launched our podcast over a year ago, our aim at the IMEU was to provide different, often untold stories about Palestine and to provide analysis to current events. Along the way, we decided to expand the podcast to include some incredible people that everyone should get to know. So we've launched a new series titled Palestinians You Should Know. Every week, we introduce you to someone new, someone who is doing some incredible things in their field. We will meet a woman who is launching a rocket to the moon, a man who, motivated by his sister's battle with cancer, is working to improve healthcare in Palestine, an award-winning screenwriter, director, and actress, a man who is trying to revive the art of mosaic making, and so many others. They share one thing in common, apart from being amazing, of course, which is that they're all Palestinian. So welcome to the series. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do. Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Butu. I'm so delighted today to be joined by somebody I really admire, who I call my friend, Melek Masar. Melek, welcome to This is Palestine.
Hi, Deanna. It's such an honor to be in this podcast. I admire you back, and you are one of the women who truly inspire me as a Palestinian woman.
Thank you. Malek, as you know, we've been starting this series of Palestinian Who is Who. And so I want people to know who you are. Can you tell us who you are and what it is that you do?
Absolutely. So my name is Malek Matar, and I'm a Palestinian painter and author of Cities Bird. I was born and raised in Gaza Strip to a family of refugees. So I was first learning about the Palestinian experience at such a young age by being, I remember in my first grade, and I was asked by my teacher to fill my city or village of origin. And that was the first confusion I had in my life. And learning about the story of how my grandparents, they were displaced from their own homes of origins, which was a Jora village. It was a quite heartbreaking to learn from this, to learn the story of, you know, the hopes and disappointments along the way. But I do think that what shaped my life as a young girl growing up was the first Israeli attack that happened in 2008. I was going to school to do my final exams, and suddenly we had this emergency situation in the school, where hundreds of students, it's such a surreal scene. Hundreds of young students, they were rushing out of the school to go home. So I was picked by my mom. She's an English teacher, and I arrived home, and I felt like it's only an emergency happening in my school, not in my home. So it was quite a tense experience being exposed to so much violence by the sounds of bombardments, and also seeing the destruction in the neighborhood and outside. But, you know, and then I go back to school in 2012, we had another Israeli attack, and 2014. But to be honest, I learned about the consequences of these Israeli attacks through school. Because as a Palestinian, I had loss from the extended family, but not from my family. And my house stayed the same and did not get demolished, thank God. But I learned about the losses of the students, the one who lost their cousins, the one that lost her house, the one that lost a real close friend. So I grew up with so much sadness and grief over the loss of loved ones. And firsthand, because it was classmates and teachers who were close to me. So what truly changed my life in 2014? And during all this time, as I was 14 years, I was really having extremely hard time communicating with people. I never spoke about my emotions, and I never had a conversation. Simply, like, I do think the Israeli attacks had part of it, like the trauma of it, but also having no access to mental health programs have made things worse, because you are dealing with it and not knowing what exactly it. You just know that there's something wrong, but there is nobody to give you a helping hand. So in 2014, we had a very long Israeli attack on Gaza. It was 51 days. The losses were immense, hundreds of people. But what truly struck me is seeing my neighbor. She was an old, loving lady. She lived just one block away from my house. Her house got bombed. And of course, my house was filled with the dust coming from the building. But once the dust disappeared, I saw how the ambulance were recovering her body from her building. And her building was never built again, because her husband he traveled outside of Gaza. But this scene has really shocked me, and I got into a breakdown. It's like, I'm going to be killed just now, because it felt too close, and it felt like I just saw it. So it was very hard for me to process. And in a way, to deal with these intense emotions and also this huge fear of losing my life, I started simply letting it go by sketches and by drawing. And also, the first medium that I used after the sketching was watercolor that I got as a gift from my school. So how did I, as a young girl, learn that art was a way of expression, of self-expression, was simply growing up in a family that saw art as a way of self-expression. My uncle, who's a visual artist, my other uncle, who was very much in love with instruments, and my grandfather, who was writing poetry. So I knew that if I wanted to express these dense emotions, then art was the answer and escape. I started making sketches, and when my mom noticed how much I was drawing, and it was in a very, very consistent way, she decided to bring me to the art store, and she brought me the mediums that I would need as an artist. And some mediums I didn't know how to use, but I learned as I was so much in love with art and how much it helped me process my feelings, but also paint the things that were meaningful to me, which is my city, my people, and also the landscapes around me, and the beauty of Gaza that I started feeling despite of the pain after each Israeli attack.
And you've done over 300 pieces, Malak, and some of your pieces, you had one piece that was even featured in GQ, Middle East. Yeah. Are you working on anything exciting right now?
So the exciting thing I'm working on is I have a solo exhibition in one of the most important museums of Portugal. And it's really coming in the 30th of November. Having this exhibition, having this first like show in Portugal is very important in a contemporary museum, because my paintings are themed about the prison, about Palestinians in the Israeli prisoners, and also about the last attack and being myself a prisoner growing up in the blockade alongside over 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. For me personally, it's revolutionary because as a Palestinian artist in a very biased art world, it's quite revolutionary to be able to speak openly about the oppression that we face as Palestinian people in the Israeli prisons, but also the occupation, the Israeli occupation on Palestine is something that we need to speak about more in the art world. And we need to also find ways to do it because of how difficult it is to bring the Palestinian voices into such an art industry that only focuses on only a class of people or a class of ethnicity, etc. And that's why, for example, I was thinking, for example, one of the Palestinians who are doing this very excellently is Muhammad Amir, Mu'amir, in his recent series, Mo. And I do think this is how we are changing the narratives, and we are helping in bringing the Palestinian story, the personal story out there. And this is why art is so important, because it brings it very honestly and very truthfully, I would say.
You mentioned that your art has more freedom of movement than you do. Can you describe how that is? I'm not sure everybody would understand that.
Yeah. So simply like when I was in Gaza and I was receiving invitations to travel, I was not able to travel because simply the blockade, the Egyptian borders were shut most of the year. And for me to leave, I would need to have a process of months of arrangements of having my name in the list of passengers. And it's such a tough way to leave. So whenever I was trying to find ways, like I can just simply try, because after Bristol, I started receiving invitations to the US, invitations to Italy and Spain. but also the blockade was the biggest issue that hindered me. So one way to do this is to be able to ship the original artwork from the Gaza Strip to these exhibitions. And my way of doing this was shipping the artwork through the mail office. And although there's a risk of the censorship of this artwork, because all the artwork that I ship from the Gaza Strip gets shipped by the Israeli mail office. So every time I go to ship my artwork, they tell me if it has any political message or content, it will not arrive. So, and also this is maybe something we can talk more about it, but the censorship that we face as Palestinians, that is pretty much in the conscious of the process of making art, is something that is really a struggle by itself. But why I say it has more freedom of movement than me, because they simply were able to travel and I was not able to travel. Although there's a long way to go for these paintings, but it's also, yeah, it's really having the freedom to be exhibited and to be seen by different audiences, and for me not to be able to be there physically. And when I had this first international exhibition, the only way I was able to talk with the audience was through a Skype. So I was seeing how much people were influenced by the idea that I was not able to go there. So it was a story by itself for the artist not to be able to present with their artwork. But I'm thankful that at least I get to exhibit my artwork, because they have the message that I want to deliver.
So I have, I've noticed that the color red features mm-hmm. prominently in your art, yeah. Malek. Can you describe why?
So the color red, I think it becomes prominent in my artwork during and after the Israeli attacks. When I choose the color, I completely go with my instinct. So in a very intense moments, I find myself going towards colors of red, because it really embodies the violence and also the blood, really the blood of people who are losing their life. And it's the scene that we see so many times through the phones, through the screen and TV, which is the blood of us Palestinians. So it becomes a color that is pretty much connected with attacks, and it's connected with the loss. When I start working more into feeling more positive and joyful, I go towards the blue, I go towards the colder colors. So it really goes according to how I feel and also the environment that I'm surrounded with.
So Malek, what is the one piece of advice that you would want to give to someone who is interested in going into art, especially in Gaza?
It's a tough road. I think, you know, being an artist is not only doing good art, because a lot of renowned artists are not really the best artists, but it's also important to be able to know how to communicate with people, because I do believe that we, as people who live under blockade and occupation, we have incredibly strong stories. And it would be a loss if you are not able to communicate it in a justly way. So I would say that it's important, along making art that is powerful and also very authentic and from the heart, but it's also important to be able to speak very well about it. I would always say that make it from the heart. You know, it's always, art is from the heart. This is how I saw it since I was just 14 till now. I do feel that what really moves people is not how sophisticated the techniques that you use or how realistic the painting is, but how honest it is and how honest you are with your piece of art. So I would say communication skills, working every day to better yourself and improve your skills, and also to have a positive approach to life. And it took me a long road to say this, because I was very negative growing up, and simply for obvious reasons. But once you see the potential in yourself, doors start opening for you. And I believe that what really, truly changed my life and changed this approach from negative to positive is a gratitude. It's to be grateful. And it transforms in a way that you can't even talk about. So I hope this helps. I don't know. I can speak a bit more about it, but that's what I can think of. Yeah.
Well, Malek, thank you for taking the time to speak to me. I admire you so much.
I admire you back.
Malek's first children's book, which is titled Sit This Bird, A Gaza yes. Story, that can be purchased through Interlink Books. Where can we get your art?
So now you can have my signed prints if you go into my Etsy. It's called Malek Art Store. So you will see signed prints, really high quality. And this is like the way that people can support my art is through purchasing these signed prints. And once my solo exhibition in Portugal ends, I think people can reach out to me through email, through Instagram, Facebook, to inquire about originals that will be released hopefully end of this year.
You know I'm going to get one.
Thank you. I would be truly honored.
Thank you very much, Malek. Thank you for taking the time to chat with me. Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. Please don't forget to subscribe. I'm Deanna Boutu. Thanks for listening.
We will have in Latin America potentially center or left-wing governments in Cuba, Honduras, Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, Bolivia, Brazil, Argentina. And these could provide opportunities at policy level, but we are still stifled by our leadership and how far these governments can go. So it does hopefully provide opportunity for grassroots movements in favor of Palestine to find space to advance a more radical and progressive agenda than what's currently being offered by our leadership.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world.
Recently, countries in Latin America, including Chile, Honduras, Colombia, and Peru, have been experiencing a new rise in leftist leaders. Indeed, earlier this year, a leftist government in Chile, headed by progressive former student leader Gabriel Boric, was elected. This was and continues to be a significant moment for Chile, which continues to suffer from policies put in place by the Pinochet dictatorship. Interestingly for Palestine, Boric is also a vocal supporter of the Palestinian struggle. In September, he postponed approving the credentials of the Israeli ambassador to Chile because of the escalation in violence against Palestinians in the West Bank at the hands of Israeli regime forces. Of course, many other Latin American leaders have also been staunch supporters of Palestine, from Hugo Chavez to Evo Morales. But Boric represents a new generation of leftists, what some analysts are referring to as the Green Wave. In other words, leftist politics that's embracing both the environment and progressive social issues such as abortion rights as a key part of policy. At the time of this recording, we were also in the midst of a general election in Brazil where leftist former President Lula is up against Bolsonaro, commonly referred to as the Trump of Latin America. Lula once said that his dream was to see a free and liberated Palestine, and he has more than once been seen donning a keffiyeh. Bolsonaro, on the other hand, considers the Israeli regime a staunch ally and has policy vis-a-vis Palestine. And his policy vis-a-vis Palestine is characterized by his courting of Christian Zionist evangelicalism. Joining me to discuss all of this and the political implications for Palestinians is Hossein Sameh. His research and writing has focused on foreign policy between Latin America and Palestine and the Israeli regime. He's written for Al Jazeera English, Plus 972 and One Device. And more recently, he has worked at both McCann and Medical Aid for Palestinians. Hossein, thank you so much for joining me on Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Palestinians have a long and varied history with Latin America, certainly not a homogenous one. But I was wondering if we could have a bit of an overview of the relationship between Latin America and Palestine and why it has been so important historically.
The beginning of the history of Palestine and Latin America arguably starts with the migration of Palestinians to Latin America in the late 18th century, early 20th century. This is while Palestine was still under the Ottoman Empire. The majority of that migration were Palestinian Christians. And when they kind of arrived in Latin America, colloquially referred to as Turcos, Turks, because they were coming from the Ottoman Empire. And there is a whole complex history of a Palestinian's relationship to the various states in which they ended up. So the majority ended up in Chile, but there's also Palestinian communities across Central America and across the other states of South America. But this, as you stated in your question, isn't necessarily a straightforward history. Palestinians have had differing relationships with both the right and left-wing governments that have emerged over the last century or so since they've been in Latin America. So many of the Palestinians who originally came to Latin America came as merchants, and as the economies of those countries began to change, found themselves moving into industry and becoming industrialists. And I think this is an important point because this relates to how these Palestinian communities then navigated the politics of the countries in which they were in. So Cecilia Baeza has done a lot of research on this, but essentially, and I think this will maybe be a recurring theme throughout this discussion, is that class interests often kind of muddied the water in terms of how Palestinians related to the states in which they found themselves. So the history of Palestinians in the region has differentiated, and Palestinians haven't necessarily always found themselves on the right side of history. You can find Palestinians kind of across the political spectrum, Palestinians who were involved in leftist organizing, and Palestinians who supported the more reactionary right-wing regimes of the continent or of the region.
So Hossein, from what you've said, Palestinians have really had a varied history across the Latin American continent. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about the Israeli regime's history with the various regimes and countries in Latin America.
Latin American states played a pivotal role in the creation of the State of Israel. So in 1947, with UN General Assembly Resolution 181, which called for the partition of Palestine into two states, 13 of the then 20 Latin American member states voted in favor, and only one state actually voted against, and that state was Cuba. And this was pre-Cuban Revolution Cuba, although I think at the time there was a reasonably progressive government in place in Cuba. Although I can't give you the exact rationale as to why Cuba was the single country to vote against. So Latin American countries played a pivotal role in partitioning Palestine, and between the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 and the War of 1967, Israel provided low-level agricultural assistance and economic assistance to those states, and the relationship between Israel and those states was relatively friendly. Israel was still also able to present itself as a reasonably progressive socialist state, kind of very much emphasizing the kibbutz experience as representative of kind of what Israel stood for. But that changed after 1967. So after the 1967 war, where not only did Israel demonstrate its settler colonial roots and its aggressiveness and oppressive policies, there was also a change in what the Israeli state felt it needed to do in order to survive. So Up until 1967, the majority of arms supplied to the Israeli state were provided by France. And 67 was really when the US kind of stepped in to be the number one financial backer, essentially, of the Israeli state. And this break with France led to the Israeli state looking to build its own arms industry and its own security industry in order to prevent being in this situation again without kind of superpower backing. And how that relates to Latin America is then Israel started to look for markets in Latin America in order to sell its weapons and to sell its military technology and military expertise. Latin America provided a very fruitful market at the time. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, Latin America was host to numerous dictatorships and right-wing movements. And the Israeli state really kind of monopolized those oppressive regimes in order to sell its weapons. For instance, in the case of Central America, Israel was one of the primary backers of the Somoza dictatorship, where it sold around $250 billion worth of arms, which made up about 98% of Nicaragua's total. They also supplied the anti-Sandinistas Contras with weapons that they'd actually confiscated from the PLO in Lebanon. They also supported the regime in El Salvador and also provided weapons to the Honduran state, which were eventually intended for the Contras who were fighting against the Sandinista revolution. Kind of most shockingly, I suppose, is Israel's involvement in Guatemala, where General Rios Montt, who launched a coup in 1982, actually attributed his success to Israeli military assistance and training. And I think it wasn't just necessarily the weapons that Israel sold in Central America, but also the ideology that it lent to these regimes and right-wing movements. So in the Salvadorian case, the army colonel Ochoa Perez actually said that he modeled his Salvadorian civil defense on a militarized version of Israeli kibbutzim. Israel also had plans with the U.S. to create a settlement-style scheme on the Costa Rican-Nicaraguan border, which was based on their settlement program in the West Bank and Gaza, the idea being to plant anti-communist farmers on the border as a means of containing the Sandinistas. And then in the Guatemalan case, there was actually the military leadership referred to the process that they were carrying out against the indigenous Guatemalans as the Palestinianization of indigenous Guatemalans. That is to treat, and this is a quote, to treat Indians like we treat the Palestinians. Don't trust any of them. And this is what they were taught. In part as a consequence of Israeli policy in Guatemala, around 75,000 Guatemalans were killed and 100,000 fled to refugee camps. So although Israel didn't actually involve itself directly in the region, through its military sales and expertise, they were able to provide assistance to these right-wing regimes. And I think that legacy is really important because the consequences of it are still being felt today, not only in terms of the instability in those countries, but also in terms of how kind of left-wing and right-wing governments then approach the question of Palestine. The reverse of that, of course, is the relationship that the PLO had with left-wing movements. So the Sandinistas in Nicaragua were a broad left-wing movement that was fighting against the Somoza dictatorship in Nicaragua, which was a dictatorship which was propped up by the US and its supporters. And so they had a very close relationship with the PLO. PLO were alleged to have provided training and money and loans to the Sandinistas. There's also accounts of Sandinistas actually participating in PLO missions in the 70s. After the success of the Sandinista revolution, in the first few weeks, I think the Sandinistas opened up an embassy for the PLO in Nicaragua, which was kind of a symbol of the relationship between the two movements. It's hard to know the extent of the PLO involvement with left-wing movements in Latin America. Of course, there was a lot of rhetoric from both left-wing movements like the Sandinistas and the PLO in terms of mutual solidarity. The extent of that materially was often played up by forces within the US who wanted to kind of tap into pro-Zionist lobby, who had a vested interest in merging the anti-communist Cold War mentality with pro-Israel support. On the other side, it's important for those left-wing movements to also effectively play up the significance of this mutual solidarity. Now, that's not to say that it wasn't genuine, but it, of course, enhanced their reputation, both the PLO and those left-wing movements, to espouse that they were working closely together. When talking about the relationship between Latin America and Palestine, it's hard to discuss that history without talking about the importance of Cuba in that story. Cuba was the first country to cut all official ties with Israel in 1973. And until this day, Cuba has no diplomatic relationships with the Israeli state. Cuba was also alleged to have sent some troops and tanks to Syria during the 1973 war. And apart from cutting off ties with Israel, Cuba has consistently been a vocal supporter of the Palestinian cause, including offering scholarships to Palestinian students to come and study in Cuba, primarily Palestinian doctors. This is something that still takes place up until today. And the legacy of that can be found in the Pink Tide governments that came to power in the 2000s. Based on this legacy that Cuba had set, you saw countries like Venezuela and Bolivia taking very tough stance against the Israeli state, also cutting off all diplomatic ties in 2009. And following on from this, we saw a wave of state recognitions of Palestine from Latin American states. Now, of course, that's not necessarily the most radical act that a state can do, but I think contextually within the kind of international scene, that had significance, probably more symbolically than anything else. So after 2009, when Venezuela and Bolivia cut ties with Israel, we saw Brazil, Ecuador, Venezuela and Bolivia, and I think some other states recognize Palestine as a state.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work.
And I guess that's something that we're used to hearing about and seeing, you know, the likes of Chavez, Morales, etc., and the leaders in Cuba talk about Palestine with such reverence. And I guess what you're saying is that it's hard to really assess how deep those relationships were. And something that was also not surprising, that, you know, that the Israeli regime exported weapons and trainings to these oppressive Latin American regimes. But I didn't realize how extensive it was and how deep it was. And I think that, you know, a really important thing you also mentioned was how the Israeli regime exported its fascist and settler colonial ideology to these regimes as well. Now, I want to hone in on Chile for a moment. Chile, as you've already mentioned, has the largest population of Palestinians outside of the Middle East. I think it stands at about 500,000, quite a sizable population considering we're only about 14 million globally. And you've touched briefly on the relationship there and the historical political relationship there. But I'm wondering, what do you think we can expect from Boric vis-a-vis foreign policy on Palestine? We know that he is a vocal supporter of Palestinian rights, but how far do you think he's willing to go?
So Chile has up to 500,000 people of Palestinian descent who are mainly based around Santiago in the Chilean capital. They have a mixed legacy when it comes to their involvement in domestic Chilean politics. And due to their class interests and many of them making up part of the industrial class, many of them actually ended up supporting the Pinochet dictatorship. Now, that's obviously not to say that all of them did, but I think there's this idea that Palestinians, by virtue of being Palestinians, are consistently righteous and on the right side of history. And I think that can often ignore the class interests of Palestinians in specific states. So despite that, Palestinians in Chile have been consistently nationalistic and pro-Palestine, and there are numerous cultural and social Palestinian associations in Chile. Most famously, I think people probably know of FC Palestino, which is a Palestinian football team based in Santiago, or a team set up by Palestinians based in Santiago. Again, like many of the Palestinian migrants to Latin America, or the original migrants, the community is primarily a Christian community coming from Bethlehem and Beit Jala. Despite the Palestinian community's mixed legacy when it comes to domestic policy in Chile, the Palestinian community there has continuously been very vocal and politically active when it comes to the Palestinian struggle. This is represented in the social, cultural institutions that they've set up in Chile. Probably best known is the football team in Santiago FC Palestino and the football shirts, which have caused a lot of controversy in Chile for showing the Palestinian map. So when it comes to the leadership of Boric, I don't think we can underestimate the importance of the Palestinian community. The support for Palestine on the policy level in Chile spans both the left and the right wing. But I think it probably doesn't make sense to see Boric's support for Palestine primarily because of some kind of pro-Palestine lobby. Boric's background is as a leftist, and I think his left-wing activism or his left-wing ideals probably better represent why he has a good position or a stronger position on Palestine than others. That being said, I think the potential for what this means for Palestine is difficult to answer. Firstly, because Chile, on a geopolitical level, even in the context of Latin America, is quite insignificant. Secondly, and I think this is a recurring theme for all the leftist governments or any leftist governments in Latin America that want to do something for Palestine, they are constrained by the fact that they can only go as far as the official leadership of the Palestinian people in terms of what they can call for. So they're almost limited or constrained by the fact that the official Palestinian leadership isn't calling for more radical solutions or radical proposals to bringing about liberation for Palestinian people. So in the case of Boric, recently he spoke at the UN General Assembly and he talked about violation of Palestinian human rights and the right for Palestinians to have a free and sovereign state. This isn't particularly different from how Palestine is talked to at the international level. What it possibly can mean, though, is having a leadership in Chile or indeed a left-wing leadership in other countries in Latin America, it does open the possibility for more grassroots organizing. The absence of a state that's hostile to Palestinian rights is something we can't take for granted when we look at the situation in the US and we look at the situation in the UK and the EU and the barriers that many grassroots campaigners are having in relation to pushing for Palestinian rights. So I think the case of Chile is interesting and it's positive, but I think many of the leaders, there's going to be this issue of how can we push the official narrative that our Palestinian leadership is giving us to push for more radical solutions. There's also other interesting developments happening in other parts of Latin America. In Colombia, they've just elected their first left-wing government. And I don't remember who, but I've often heard Colombia being referred to in the past as the Israel of Latin America, which kind of speaks to the fact that that Colombia has served for many, many decades as the bastion of US policy in the region. And indeed, Colombia was one of the last countries to take this symbolic step, symbolic as it is, of recognizing the Palestinian state. Now, the government in Colombia now is headed by Gustavo Petro, who is a former leftist guerrilla. And he hasn't said too much about Palestine in the past, but in terms of his foreign policy so far or what he's looking to do, we can see him making progressive steps in relation to Cuba, in relation to Colombian-Cuban relations and Colombian-Venezuelan relations. And so hopefully the new Colombian government can also provide as an ally for Palestinians. The last thing I wanted to say is also important not to overstate identity as a rationale for supporting Palestine. So although, of course, there is a huge Palestinian community in Chile, and that's going to have an effect on Chilean foreign policy. If we look at a state like El Salvador, which currently has a president of Palestinian descent, Nayib Bukele, he's actually gone out of his way to show himself to be a friend of Israel. And I think that's happened to the distaste of the Palestinian community in El Salvador, which is quite large, but that still goes to show that class interests or other interests can often trump identity. So we can't just rely on thinking, well, there's lots of Palestinians in this particular community, therefore we're going to have a pro-Palestinian response from the leadership.
I think that's a really important point, Hussein. And another important thing you mentioned is that, you know, whilst the Palestinian leadership continues to fail to represent their people and put forward radical agenda for liberation, we can hardly expect other states to do that for us. I wanted to move on and to talk about Brazil, because Brazil is in the midst of a general election. The runoffs are due to take place shortly after the airing of this episode. So I was wondering if you could briefly discuss the implications for Palestinians if Lula takes office, and also perhaps what might happen if we see Bolsonaro re-elected.
I really hope that we don't see Bolsonaro re-elected, but it is a possibility. The polls in Brazil are very tight at the moment. Lula was predicted to potentially win the election in the first round, but it is going to a second round. I think we can't take for granted a Lula victory. Now, what a Lula victory would mean for Palestine, well, I think from purely symbolic position or from a purely symbolic perspective, defeating Bolsonaro is a must. So Bolsonaro has, as you stated in your introduction, has courted the Christian evangelical right wing in Brazil, which is huge, and who are very vocal supporters of Israel, has courted them by taking policy on Palestine, Israel, that is very much to the right. He's threatened to move the Brazilian embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, although he hasn't actually done it, but he has opened up a trade mission in Jerusalem. He's also opposed investigations into Israeli war crimes, well, the ICC investigations. His sons were seen while Bolsonaro was on a trip to Israel, seen donning IDF T-shirts. And I think the Bolsonaro movement very much looks to Israel as a bastion of kind of right-wing values, of militarization, of kind of security, of, you know, defenders of what in Brazil they call like the good citizens, cidadão de bem. Now, what a Lula victory would mean, Lula has rhetorically been very pro-Palestine in the past. And like I said, Brazil was one of the first states to recognize the state of Palestine. But business as usual has kind of continued between Brazil and Israel in terms of trade. Despite Lula's progressive stance on Palestine, the Mercosul Israel Free Trade Agreement was signed during Lula's presidency. I don't have the exact figures to hand, but I don't think trade has stopped. And I think that's also the case in Chile. Although Boric has drafted a law regarding settlement products, again, that's not wildly far from kind of international consensus. And it doesn't go far enough. And I think in the Brazilian case, it is very important that Lula wins. And I think Lula will, at least rhetorically, be, of course, a lot more pro-Palestine than Bolsonaro. But until we see changes in trade, arms imports, I think, you know, it's still very much maintaining the status quo. Lula has also had to move to the right in order to, well, in his opinion, in order to defeat Bolsonaro. So I don't know what Lula in 2022 will look like compared to Lula in the past. But he has run the campaign trail once again, I think, as you mentioned in your introduction, met with the Palestinian community, Warner Kafir, reiterated his support for Palestine. Much like the rest of Latin America, at least at the leadership level or the state level, unsurprisingly, support for Palestine is still through the lens of statism. So because the only thing that the Palestinian Authority has to offer in terms of bringing about any change is an establishment of a state based on the two-state solution, it's kind of the only thing that Latin American leaders can actually support. So again, until that changes, I think it's hard to see what the significance or what these leaders can actually do. I think in the case of Brazil, Lula is likely to be hampered by the success of Bolsonaro in the elections, although it's going to a second round. Bolsonaro actually did quite well, or at least his party or his supporters did quite well in the elections. Looking beyond Palestine in a way, it is extremely important that Bolsonaro is defeated. Bolsonaro, not only a friend of Israel or supporter of Israel, but he has made attacks on Black Brazilians, on Indigenous Brazilians, on LGBTQ plus Brazilians. And I think he stands against everything that the Palestinian Liberation Movement should stand for. And just anecdotally, when I was in Brazil, when you went to the anti-PT, which is the party that Lula represent, when I went and visited the anti-PT protests, it would be common to see Israeli flags alongside Brazilian flags. And the merger of Zionism or pro-Israel sentiment and these right-wing values is scary to witness, but it also speaks to the importance of defeating Bolsonaro.
Hussein, just to bring this episode to a close, I want to ask you about the future of the relationship between Palestinians and Latin America. Where do you see it going? And what do you think needs to be strengthened in terms of ally ties with the region?
As we've talked about today, Latin America is home to a large Palestinian population and community. And I think we need to continue to tap into that and to mobilize that base and to support that base and to provide resources for Palestinians who are often in certain contexts quite assimilated into their host state, to provide means or support in empowering them about their Palestinian heritage and history and politics. So I think ignore the fact that Latin America is home to so many Palestinians. I think we also need to move beyond the idea of engaging with Latin America just because it's the home of many people of Arab or Palestinian descent. Because again, that ignores the class interests that some of those communities may have, which contradict perhaps where we want to see Palestinian liberation move. Like, it's not enough just to be pro-Palestine if that means that you're pro-business or leads you to side with the right. We need to mobilize Palestinians to be progressive in all senses. And I think that's why it's important for us as Palestinians to tap into or to support indigenous struggles in Latin America, to support decolonial organizing, anti-racist organizing, abolitionist organizing, feminist and queer organizing. And I think in many ways, what's exciting about what's happening in Latin America is probably less to do with Palestine and more to do with the success of organizing and protests in building power. So Boric in Chile came into power off the back of maybe not consistent, but 10 years of protests on the street. The election of Gustavo Petro in Colombia comes off the back of indigenous and mass movement in the last year or so. And I think that also speaks to the potential of Palestinians in diaspora to build connections and to build struggle with Latin Americans. So during the uprising of the Unity Intifada last year, this coincided with these mass uprisings that we saw in Colombia and we saw on the streets of many places in North America and in Europe, Palestinians and Colombians protesting and marching together and making connections between their struggles and the support of the US in both projects, the militarization or the military connections in both countries. So I think there is a lot to build up from. As I said before, we currently have, or we will have in Latin America, potentially center or left-wing governments in Cuba, Honduras, Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, Bolivia, Brazil, Argentina. And these could provide opportunities at policy level. But we are still stifled by our leadership and how far these governments can go. I can't remember who said it, but they can't be more Palestinian than the Palestinians. So it does hopefully provide opportunity for grassroots movements in favor of Palestine to find space to advance a more radical and progressive agenda than what's currently being offered by our leadership. And I think on the other hand, we also need to be wary of the rise of fascism in Latin America. When we look at the recent elections and many of where these leftist leaders were elected, they were often running against far right or right opponents. So much so that in the Brazil case, the irony is that Lula is now running with his former opponent in the last election. So the traditional right that Lula once used to battle against has now become an ally against the far right. So I think we do have to be wary of the potential right-wing backlash. We also need to be wary of the constraints that are going to be placed upon these left-wing governments once they come into power, the tension between quote-unquote development and the most marginalized and indigenous people in those states. But I think we also have to consider Latin America is also made up of settler colonial states. The structures of these states are built on settler colonialism in a similar way to how the structure of Israel has been built. So there's still constraints for these left-wing governments. And we also need to keep an eye on the rise of the Christian evangelical right wing, particularly in Brazil, who are very pro-Israel. That isn't to say, though, that we can't engage with them. I think we need to maybe find avenues to think about how we can actually engage those communities around the question of Palestine.
Hussein, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining me on Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you for listening to Rethinking Palestine. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. For more policy analysis and to donate to support our work, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Montreal International Documentary Festival is celebrating its 25th edition, a unique opportunity to enjoy the best documentary films from all around the world.
This fall, the RIDM returns exclusively to theaters and venues with screenings, festivities, and much more.
See you from November 17th to the 27th.
Discover the full program at RIDM.ca.
The RIDM, where all stories meet.